And he will speak to us on the chronology of the fall, the transition of the nature of humanity to the post-fall creation. And once again, I'd like to urge the speakers to try to allow some time for questions. The half hour, next half hour is yours.
Reach all the way over. Can you just move it over so I can reach? It'll be fine. There's a lot that's been said about the chronology of the origin of the world and the origin of life, but generally delegated to a rare chapter towards the end of the book or a paragraph is a discussion of the chronology of the fall. And today I would like to give somewhat of an overview and look at a wide spectrum of theories about the chronology of the fall. In what time span did it happen? I will spend most of my time on an instantaneous point of view, which I feel is probably dominant among evangelical circles. But I will also spend some time about a concept of a dual fall with a dual curse, a retroactive notion where the curse comes before the fall. That sense, a gradual fall and curse. We'll have to spend some time on atemporal notions, that there is no chronology of the fall. And finally, I'll explain what I mean about an inverse fall. So we'll discuss each of these in order. First of all, let's look at instantaneous, by which we mean anything up to 100 years or so, I mean, which is instantaneous for geological perspectives, of course. Now, what it really means instantaneous is that there was a time when there was what we call a pre-fall condition, then there was a transition to a post-fall condition in a very brief amount of time. But there are widely varying views about the scope of that change. How much change was there at the time of the fall? And I'd like to take a closer look at five scopes, or across the whole spectrum here, five different scopes. We'll take a look at each one of these five. At one end of the spectrum, you have people who postulate a radical change. The laws of physics and everything changed at the fall. At the other end of the spectrum, you have those who say it's only a spiritual effects, no physical changes whatsoever. It's highly spiritualized. In the middle, you have a whole spectrum of those who say, well, just biology got affected here. You know, we physicists are in the pure field, so it didn't get affected. But the biologists have a problem here. Some who look only at the anthropic extent of the fall. Some who focus on psychology. And then, of course, the spiritual. Let's look at each one of these in turn. What do we mean by it? And what are some of the problems in those areas? It is really the catastrophists, the scientific creationists with the catastrophic view, who have proposed a radical change in the universe at the time of the curse. The catastrophists talk about three significant events, the creation, the fall, and the flood. And the main point for them is that there was a fundamental change in the universe, and when they get the specific, the only thing they really mention in detail is the second law of thermodynamics. The reasoning is that this law implies an increase of entropy or disorder, which is clearly not very good, so that couldn't have happened before the fall. Therefore, this law of physics was introduced at the time of the fall. That was a considerable transition. Now, what are the problems with this kind of a view? First of all, I think we have to recognize that it really is not taught in Scripture. There is no clear teaching of a radical, sweeping change. A literal reading of Genesis 3 talks about simple changes. It doesn't talk about sweeping global changes. It has to be inferred in a long chain of assumptions in order to get to this. So it's not clearly taught in Scriptures. But more important, and this is one of the key ideas I wanted to express in my paper today, is an inconsistency with Scripture. That is, if you try to have a literal reading of Scripture in order to get this radical change, you end up with an inconsistency. How's this? Well, if you follow the implications of not having a second law of thermodynamics, the implications are immense. Because this whole notion of increase of entropy or disorder is the very law that causes water to exist as a liquid below the boiling point. If you don't have a second law of thermodynamics, you don't have water. The second law of thermodynamics really is a description of every single physical process. That's what determines blood flowing through our veins, every single process. If you don't have that law, you don't have water, you don't have life, you don't have anything. Yet Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 clearly indicate that water was created before the fall. And if you want a literal reading, you're suddenly caught in an inconsistency. Okay? And the inconsistency arises because people fail to understand the implications of the second law of thermodynamics. So you get this kind of inconsistency. But we haven't even begun to talk about another topic that's a favorite of mine, is that you don't really see discontinuities in nature. You can go backwards in time for geology and astronomy. You do not see discontinuities of physical processes. It doesn't mean they aren't there. We haven't seen them yet. Well, because of these problems, many people, even in the scientific creationists, back off and say, well, all right, maybe the laws of physics are still the same. But you have to admit that there was something different in the organic realm, that now you started to get death and decay into the plant and animal kingdoms, a pervasive change in the way that the biological systems work. You have parasitic plants and carnivorous animals, and this can be deduced with various phrases, including the introduction of death into the world, and some statements are made about the changes about the serpents and snakes. But at any rate, there's a considerable change in the laws of biology. Now, I'd like to say that you still haven't overcome the problem of inconsistency. And the argument here is that what are the implications of a change in the laws of biology? Those of you who went to Moss Lake yesterday found a delicate balance of an ecological system. One of the most important aspects of that ecosystem was a concept of decay of some type. Without that, the existence of that whole system would be radically different. And I would like to suggest this afternoon that if death and decay did not exist in the plant and animal kingdoms, the change in the whole biological structure would be so radically different that we would not recognize any of the so-called biological systems. Even the herbivorous type of animals really are designed with mortality in mind. The reproductive systems of animals, take for example rabbits, with no mortality rate of the rabbits, it wouldn't take very many years to populate the Earth. But the point is that the entire biological system is geared and intricately related to death and decay. If you don't have that, the structure is changed so much that you would no longer recognize the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the living creatures that we have in Genesis 1 and 2. You still have a problem with inconsistency. And again, we don't even have to mention the fact that there is evidence that plant and animal death occurred before you can postulate human existence. That's another whole direction which must be dealt with. Well, for these reasons, I believe, I haven't taken a poll, but I would guess that the majority of the ASA members probably adhere to something of this type of view, an instantaneous or anthropic view. This is very consistent with the progressive creationist's view of the creation. What it does here is to say, all right, the plant animal kingdom, they probably were involved with death and decay all along, but the curse dealt solely with humans. Okay? That is, although animals died beforehand, humans didn't. And after the sin, there was a radical change in humans only, that human suffering and human death were the curse. You notice the gradual transition here. Now, we're limiting more and more the scope of the curse. Now you have a whole new set of problems. Well, actually, not whole new. Let's jump to this one first. I still think that there's a residue here of the inconsistency argument. I would question whether a human being that cannot suffer or that does not suffer, that cannot die, is really a human being that we would recognize. I can't prove that. I can't disprove it. But I question very much that the change required to have no human suffering and no death and no pain would be so radical that it would not be what you and I would call a human being. And yet God did create male and female human beings. So you still have some of that inconsistency argument. But now you start a whole new game. How do you justify the separation of natural evil from human sin? And we ought to take 2 hours right now to define natural evil. Unfortunately, we're not allowed that time. Let's take a very simplistic view, and let's just say it has to do with suffering and death that is not mediated or initiated from human activity. It's not very satisfactory, but for now it's an operational definition. So there are implications from Scripture that there is a relationship. I'm not a theologian. I don't know how strong they are, but it's in a lot of our Orthodox thinking, and that's a problem that has to be dealt with and is non-trivial. Now, there's another area of evidence of early human-like death. I word it carefully, human-like. We don't really know whether these skeletons or brief forms of fossils were really humans or not. Depends on your definition of humans, and we can probably never show that. But somehow you have to deal with this. There were creatures that looked very much like humans who did die very early before you could possibly postulate human sin. Well, for those reasons, many people back off and say, well, it wasn't a physical effect in humans, but it was a psychological effect. It was an issue of our perception that what really happens is we suddenly recognize good and evil. It was there all along, but we didn't really see it. We were dying physically, but we weren't aware of it. So it was the recognition of death, this living with the process of dying, that really was the curse. It was this recognition. So you have a psychic scope, okay? Something that had to deal with the mind only, that the physical processes did not change. Now you've got some real danger, because you're starting to minimize the reality of evil. You're saying that evil is all in what you perceive, okay? And you start to minimize that reality. And we have to be careful about that. You still have this notion of the separation of natural evil and human sin, of the predating. We have to account for that in some way, and that's hard. And if we go on to the spiritual realm, it just takes it one step further to the end of the spectrum, where you say it's not so much of a spectrum or a perception, but that the real curse is a separation from God. When it talks about death, it's a spiritual death, okay? Not a physical death. Now you really have to deal with the issue that scriptures do teach some relationship between physical death and suffering, and that these are a result of human sin. We have to deal with that in some theological terms. If I can now summarize the scope of the theories of an instantaneous change with the fall, you have everything from the far right, where you have a radical change in creation at the fall, all the way to the far left, where you have a spiritualized change. And you have a lot of ASA people, I think, who love to avoid extremes and take a kind of a central position. Seems to be safe. Unfortunately, at this end, where we are concerned about an inconsistency with the doctrine of creation, and where we observe a lot of continuity in nature, you have the problems on the left side about the New Testament teachings of the impact of sin and of the relationship of natural evil, and the people in the middle get all four, really haven't solved the problem very neatly. Well, in order to address those kind of issues, there are lots of other theories around. Wherever there's a problem, there's another theory to address it. And one of them, which correlates a lot with the gap theory of creation, has to do with the dual fall and the curse. The fall of Lucifer resulted in a natural evil in this world, but moral evil is then attributed to human sin in Adam and Eve. Okay? That has a lot of advantages, because now you can explain natural evil and moral evil, and you can explain why there's a lot of death existing before Adam and Eve could have existed. It seems to be a little neat, but there's really no clear scriptural support for it. And I emphasize the word clear because some people do claim there is scriptural support, but to get Genesis 1:2 and some vague references in Isaiah and the apocryphal literature to support this, I'm not so sure that I'm ready to buy it. It's a possibility, and somehow, you know, there might have been an effect of the fall of Lucifer, but it's not supported very strongly. This may be correct, but we can't deduce it simply from Scripture. But you still have this decoupling of the moral and natural evil in the sense that the natural evil is still not related to human sin in itself. Okay? It's related to Lucifer's sin. Perhaps that's all right from a theological view. I don't know. But it's something that has to be dealt with in this dual relationship. Now, in order to relate the natural evil to the human sin, we can talk about a retroactive system. And it was a couple of years ago, read an article where some people talked about a universe that was created with natural evil for humans who would commit moral evil. The notion was that the natural evil was there in the universe before it occurred. And their rationale was that human sin is the reason, even if it's not the scientific cause and effect relationship, but it's nevertheless the reason for the existence of natural evil in the universe. Okay? And I think those of you who read George Murphy's article in the March ASA, he alluded to a similar type of thinking where you could have this causal relationships in a different direction. You refer not only to some of the new physics and the quantum mechanical possibilities, but also to the correlation with the cross, which is effective in all directions, both forward and backwards. So you have this possibility that human sin later in time, you know, the results emanate forward and backward in time. It's something that bears a lot of thinking. I'm not so sure how in this system we reconcile it with moral freedom. If the environment in which Adam and Eve find themselves is already manifest with the results of their sin, maybe you can resolve it, but maybe it will take some awkward definitions of moral freedom. I'm not enough of a philosopher to carry that through. I need some help there. And we also start seeing this problem with the notion that the universe was created good. If God said this universe is good, what does that mean? Can we attribute evil back at that time? There's another idea that I got from reading Carl Sagan's book, The Dragons of Eden, and was, even though he's an atheist, to be able to interpret that from a theistic point of view is not too difficult, where Carl Sagan points out an intriguing relationship between the story in Genesis 3 and evolutionary development of hominids, really. There happens to be a short period of time, and those who favor punctuated equilibrium especially address the very rapid evolutionary development that was characterized by an increase in cranial capacity. Okay, really, the transition to Homo sapiens was an increase in cranial capacity, which is correlated with a number of things. It's correlated with the first observable of burial rites, indicating some religious bent, the first appearance of art with certain skills. And he points out, that correlates very nicely with the development of the knowledge of good and evil. Then he points out that the curse, which was to be bearing children in pain, the real cause of painful childbirth, is the fact that the cranium increased far more rapidly than the size of the pelvis. And as a result, there's pain. And he says, wow, look at that. You know, we see an evolutionary development neatly correlated and described by Genesis 3. Well, I think that's amusing reading. I'm not so sure it's very good theology. You still have a lot of problems with the natural evil and human sin. You don't address any of that. But furthermore, you have a very limited scope of the curse. It doesn't extend very far. You may be able to drive it farther than Sagan himself does, but I'm not so sure it's going to be a very fruitful direction. Now, one that needs to be taken more seriously is an atemporal fall. I first read about this from Richard Bube's article in an ASA journal many years ago, and some of you may have read that, where he points out we have to grapple with the possibility that there really isn't a before or after in the fall, that Genesis 3 is not a chronological story, but it tells us of the fact of the need for redemption. It points out that this creation is a fallen creation. It doesn't tell us anything about the chronology. And reading Conrad Heyer's Meaning of Creation, my guess is that he would see very much the same thing. But the message of the story is the existence of evil in this world and says nothing about the origin or the chronology of that development. Okay. So somehow, whatever evil is there somehow develops inherently in the universe. But there's the rub. We still don't have a clean explanation of that. That origin of that natural evil, which is somehow inherently there, leaves us a little cold. And still that notion that the universe was created good. We need to stay away from any suggestion of dualism at the creation, that God really was good and evil, or direct author of the evil, I guess it borders on blasphemy, and we want to stay away from that. How do we correlate that? That's not an easy one, but from looking at those texts, this is a possibility that we cannot throw out automatically. We have to grapple with that. There was another possibility that I thought of after reading George Murphy's article in the ASA, and he alluded to a similar concept. I've modified it a little bit. I think he attributed it back to some Eastern Christian ideas what he mentioned was that there is a turning away from the path, which is really the human sin. Now, I kind of altered that a little bit to say, well, you could have something where the whole notion of fall is backwards. Rather than a transition from good to evil, it's a transition from evil to good. Okay? The story of the fall just tells us that, that there's a goal to be worked for, but that the creation and the rest of history is a transition from evil to good. We have creation from nothing, in a sense. And then you have the central story of redemption, where not just in the crucifixion and resurrection, but throughout Scripture, you have stories and examples and ideas where God is working good from evil in the world. Okay? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, kind of concept. Well, is it possible that we could think of this as an ongoing process throughout history? Now, you might say this is much too dangerously close to the secular humanists who turn around and say, of course, we're all naturally good and we're evolving to a good state. Yes, it is dangerously close to that. But on the other hand, it's an intriguing thought about how redemption might pervade the entire process of creation. Am I really recommending this? No, I can't say I do, except for further thought and for possibility. And I would recommend not throwing this out so much as exploring some things, because again, it says nothing about the concept of the origin of evil, and still the New Testament teaching of the origin of death and this good creation, those problems are still there. Well, I hate to tell you that I don't have any answers. There's not a clean solution that I can see. Described a spectrum of about 10 or so widely differing views of the chronology of the fall. It seems to me that the scriptures really don't clearly teach the chronology of the fall. If you say that Genesis 3 clearly teaches an instantaneous transition, then I'm going to ask you about some of your consistencies. You know, how can you make that consistent with the doctrine of creation, which teaches that the world we see was created in that fashion, without a radical change? It's not clear. Perhaps it teaches something about it. I don't see it very clear. On the other hand, studies of nature in physics, in geology, we don't see any discontinuity of physical processes. And again, I state it this way because maybe there was one and we don't see it. But we don't see any evidence. We do see indications that processes that are going on now did occur long before we can justifiably postulate the existence of an Adam and an Eve. Okay? Granted, that makes it all the more difficult to spell out a clear chronology of the fall. But what I want to leave with you very strongly is that whatever view you select, maybe one of these or a combination, there could be lots of combinations, which you feel doesn't present too many problems with you, whichever view you select, every concept, as you noted, agreed on the fact of the fallenness of the world and the need for redemption. So the message is, just as we know little about, from Scripture at least, about the mechanism of creation, the fact of creation and our Creator is clearly taught. Just so in the fall, we know very little about the chronology of the fall, but we do know that there is, that we live in a fallen world, and each of us is in the need, has a need for redemption.
Thank you. We have some time for some questions.
Yeah, Randy.
Go ahead.
Well, the dualism you were concerned with doesn't bother me as much, perhaps, as you. I think as soon as water is created,